is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. We have some wonderful guests on for you today. In the first half, we are going to have John Sinclair talking about the Canadian healthcare system. And in the second half, we have naturopath Catherine Kibluski, and she's going to be talking about food for your gut. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
There's no evidence to support the notion that people who get the flu vaccine every year somehow weaken their immune system over time, researchers say. In fact, annual vaccinations seem tied to stronger immune cell activity, according to the Norwegian research team. That's even true for years where the flu shot is a poor match for flu viruses actually circulating, as happened in the 2016-17 season, the findings suggest. The study was led by Rebecca Cox of the University of Bergen's Department of Clinical Science. Her group tracked the immune system health of 250 healthcare workers. Some of the participants got the flu shot beginning in 2009 and then every year thereafter, while others only got the shot in 2009, but then no shot between 2010 and 2013. The report by Cox's team was published in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. It's often said that timing is everything. New research suggests this may be true when giving an insulin pill to try to prevent or delay type 1 diabetes. Researchers tested the effect of insulin pills on 560 children and adults whose relatives had type 1 diabetes. For most of them, the drug had no effect on whether or not they developed type 1 diabetes or how quickly they developed it. But for those at the highest risk of developing type 1 diabetes sooner rather than later, insulin pill therapy delayed the time it took to develop the full-blown disease by about 2.5 years, the researchers said. This is the largest study using oral insulin, said the study's lead author, Dr. Carla Greenbaum. Participants also had known autoantibodies that indicated a very high risk of developing type 1 diabetes in their lifetimes, said Greenbaum, chair of Diabetes Trial Net. The study was published in the November 21st issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. Men who compete in triathlons could be putting their hearts at risk, a new study contends. The finding results from an examination of 55 male triathletes who averaged 44 years old and 30 female triathletes with an average age of 43. All participated in triathlons, which involve sequential endurance competitions of swimming, cycling, and running. The researchers found that 18% of the men had evidence of scarring of the heart, known as myocardial fibrosis. None of the women had signs of the condition. Myocardial fibrosis usually affects the pumping chambers and can progress to heart failure. Study lead author Dr. Yitka Sterkova said the clinical relevance of these scars is currently unclear, but they might be a foundation for future heart failure and arrhythmia, or irregular heartbeat. The study was to be presented during the annual meeting of the Radiological Society of North America, November 26th to December 1st. If you develop both diabetes and high blood pressure during pregnancy, you face a much higher risk of future trouble than women who only develop one of those conditions while pregnant, researchers report. And that future trouble can include heart disease, the Canadian researchers added. To reach that conclusion, the research team looked at 64,000 couples in the province of Quebec. Having either diabetes or high blood pressure during pregnancy increased a woman's future risk of diabetes by 15 times. The risk was 37 times higher among women who had both conditions during pregnancy. Having either diabetes or high blood pressure during pregnancy doubled a woman's future risk of high blood pressure, but the risk was 6 times higher among women who had both conditions during pregnancy, the study found. The study was published November 14th in the American Journal of Epidemiology.
Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. We have some great guests on today. In the first half of the show, we will be speaking to John Sinclair. He's a certified professional in the health management sector. And in the second half, we will be speaking with Dr. Holly Lucille. She's naturopathic physician and author, and we'll be speaking about breast cancer and breast cancer prevention. But before we do that, here is Alan with the health news.
People who speak two or more languages appear to weather the ravages of Alzheimer's disease better than people who have only mastered one language, a new Italian study suggests. Bilingual people with Alzheimer's outperform single language speakers in short and long-term memory tasks, even though scans showed more severe deterioration in brain metabolism among the bilingual participants, the scientists said. The ability to speak two languages appears to provide the brain with more resilience to withstand damage from Alzheimer's, said lead researcher Dr. Daniela Parani, a professor of psychology at Vita Salute San Rafael University in Milan. The more often a person switched between two languages during their lifetime, the more capable their brains became of switching to alternate pathways that maintained thinking skills, even as Alzheimer's damage accumulated, the researchers found. The new study was published January 30th in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Mentally stimulating activities can protect your brain against aging, even if you're genetically predisposed toward dementia or Alzheimer's disease, a new study reports. Activities that keep the brain busy, using a computer, crafting, playing games, and participating in social activities, appear to lower the risk of age-related mental decline in people 70 and over, the Mayo Clinic study found. Co-author Dr. Ronald Peterson said these kind of commonly engaged in stimulating activities actually reduce the risk of people developing mild cognitive impairment. He's director of the Mayo Clinic Alzheimer's Disease Research Center in Rochester, Minnesota. For their study, Mayo researchers followed more than 1,900 mentally healthy men and women participating in the Mayo Clinic study of aging for 4 years on average. Their average age when the study began was 77. The study was published January 30th in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Kids who follow a Mediterranean diet, high in fruits, vegetables, and good fats, may be less likely to have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, a small study suggests. Research on 120 children in Spain found that those with low adherence to the traditional Mediterranean diet were 7 times more likely to have ADHD. In general, kids with ADHD ate fewer fruits, vegetables, and fatty fish, and more junk food and fast food, according to the study findings. However, the findings point only to a correlation and not a cause and effect link between the Mediterranean diet and ADHD, said experts who were not involved in the study. No one knows whether the diet can actually ward off the attention and behavior problems associated with ADHD. The study was published online January 30th in the journal Pediatrics. Some pediatric health experts may have loosened the reins a bit on screen time for the youngest of children, but that doesn't mean parents should rely on electronic devices as babysitters, one pediatrician says. Most of us use media every day, said Dr. Sarah Lee, who's with University Hospital's Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland. It's how we interact with the world, and it's how we learn new ideas. Children will need to know how to use these forms in healthy, effective ways, Lee said in a hospital news release. New guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics give parents a lot more guidance on how to use media with their kids at home, she added. In the new screen time guidelines for children, the AAP admitted there are notable benefits associated with educational shows or apps and connecting with friends and loved ones online, Lee said. One of the main points of the new recommendations is the importance of watching these programs and apps together, said Lee.
John Sinclair is a university guest lecturer, a sought-after speaker at healthcare conferences in Canada and around the world, and he's the president of Novari Health. Solutions-focused, he is an advocate for using proven and innovative made-in-Canada technology to improve access to care for Canadian patients. Welcome, John.
Good afternoon, Kathy.
Nice to have you on the show. So the Fraser Institute released its healthcare wait times report last November. What are the highlights?
Well, it's not good, but we already knew that before the Fraser report came out.
Right.
I think most Canadians, including probably you and I, both know from our experience, our personal experience, or from that of our families, that wait times are an issue in Canada. They've been that way for a few decades now. The Fraser report just reinforced that, but I think there really was nothing new per se in the Fraser report. It just validated what we already know.
So you could either get better or die before you get help.
Well, I'd rather look internationally and see how we compare against other Western industrialized countries, the Australias, New Zealand, the Scandinavian countries, the European countries, and we didn't perform very well against those countries. We spend about what they do, maybe a little bit more, in fact, and yet our wait times are not very good when we compare ourselves against our peer countries. So the Fraser report, the methodology, and I know we don't want to get into the science of it per se, but the methodology that they followed was fairly weak. They have their own agenda. So we don't need to put a lot of weight on that report specifically, but we do need to take heed that wait times are not good in Canada for many healthcare services, and it varies across the country. Sort of what you're waiting for depends where you live and what you're experiencing.
What country has the best healthcare?
Oh, that's a great question. So it really depends. It depends what you're... There is no answer to that question. There's no one answer. There's many answers to that question. And researchers in the healthcare field have looked at that. And what you kind of want to do is you want to go around the world and cherry-pick, because some countries do surgical wait times very well, but they might be weaker in other areas. So if we could just cherry pick the best around the world and then massage those to fit the Canadian healthcare system, it would be ideal. But then we're faced with a little bit of reality that it's hard to change healthcare. It's a big monster in every province. It's very change resistant for good reason. In fact, you don't want it's change resistant because they're doing very important things with people's lives. And so you don't want to change willy-nilly. You want to make sure that it's driven by science, and you want to be very conservative. So change comes slowly to healthcare. I mean, we still see the fax machine being used here in 2017 in healthcare, but really in no other industry. So change comes slowly to healthcare. To come back to your question, I would point you to the Scandinavian countries. I think they lead the way. I think New Zealand preaches that they've got the best wait times, but I think when you sort of scratch the surface, that's really not the case. So let's look towards the Scandinavian countries.
What are the Canadians waiting the longest for? Is there certain areas that are harder to get into and a lot longer waits?
There are. So when we think of wait times, we think of it both for the wait time to see a specialist, and we can even back up and say there's wait times in Canada to see primary care. So we wait to see primary care. We wait for imaging requisition. So let's say your primary care physician or your specialist sends you for an MRI or a CT scan. There are wait times in those areas too. Then there's wait times to see the specialist. And then if you see a specialist, let's say a surgeon, and you agree to have surgery and the surgeon agrees to perform the surgery, then you typically wait for that surgical procedure. We call that wait two, in fact. So just to give it a name, wait one is the wait time to see the specialist, and wait two is the time for the actual procedure. So it varies across the country, both the wait one and wait two wait times, and it varies by specialty or by procedure. But at a high level, the big waiters are typically cataract procedures, hip and knee procedures, so waiting for a hip replacement or a knee replacement. And another big one is MRI and CT scans. So those imaging wait times. So if you had to pick the top three, those would be amongst the top three anyway.
Okay. So the healthcare, those that are in crisis, that where it's life or death, they get to go first. By the sounds of it, cataracts and knees, you can live long with.
So you're making a really good point, Kathy, in that we do triage patients in Canada. So, if you're in a car accident or, there's been trauma or something is urgent, as you put it, life-threatening, those patients typically don't wait more than a day or two for their procedure. Wait times kick in when we're talking about elective cases. Now, elective might not be the best word, but what we mean by that is patients that are ambulatory, in other words, they can walk typically, they don't, it's not life or limb, and they can afford to wait. There really is very little research globally around what is an appropriate wait time. So how long should someone wait, or how long could they wait, let's say, to have their cataract done or to have their hip or their knee replaced. We do triage. So we're talking about the elective side of the house, if you will.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the consequences of these long healthcare waits?
Well, I like to think of it this way. There's sort of two buckets of consequences. One are systematic, or at the society level. Mm-hmm. We have patients waiting. If they're waiting, they're often in pain, or there's some deficit, i.e. they can't see clearly. And if they're in pain, waiting a day in pain seems like a long time. So if you're waiting for that hip replacement and you're waiting 6 months for your procedure and you're in some pain or some discomfort, there's a personal toll for that, but there's also a toll at the society level. Those people are not being as productive as they could. They're taking more time off, perhaps taking more medications. So both at the individual level and at the society level, there are consequences that would be measured in the hundreds of millions of dollars annually if we looked across the country. So if you add up all the time that Canadians are not being as productive as they could, the numbers are staggering.
Okay. So would more money and more healthcare funds, would that reduce the wait time? How could we shorten it up?
Well, there's no short answer to that question. Also, it's a great question. So, money always helps. Of course it does. But the international research done by the OECD specifically has really shown that simply throwing more money at wait times doesn't solve the problem. You need to be more creative, more innovative than that. And things like waitlist management, I mean, just having computerized software that manages, in like air traffic control manages airplanes in the air, waitlist management software, managing all of the patients, triaging all of the patients, and making sure that the right patients get scheduled at the right time. There's something that clearly has been demonstrated to help. That's being done in parts of the country, but not other parts of the country. Systematic changes like central intake, having all hip and knee referrals, for example, in a city. So let's take a city in Canada, Kelowna, British Columbia. So if all of the surgical referrals for hips and knees were to go to a central location, and then those patients were seen perhaps by an advanced practice physiotherapist, and then they were triaged at that level and then routed to individual surgeons, so the wait time is equal for all patients and it's coordinated care. That's something that we could be doing, and it's also being done in pockets across the country. So there's a number of things. What we're not doing right off the cuff is we're not really using technology to its fullest.
Okay. And do we have people running out and paying for their surgeries now in Canada just to get in ahead of the line, or is it fairly even trying to get in?
So, you know, that whole issue of private versus public, you know, that's a political issue. At the end of the day, I'm kind of agnostic in that regard. Mm-hmm. We see around the world systems where there are public and private, and it's mixed, and they also have wait times.
Okay.
So I think that's a bit of a red herring. Okay. I don't think that necessarily solves the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, we look at the U.S. healthcare system, which is you know, a completely different animal than ours, and they have access to care issues. They have lots of uninsured individuals. We don't have that problem in Canada. We have wait times, which is the other side of the coin. So there is no magic bullet here.
Okay. And in the technological world, how can this technology speed things up and help us? You know, one thing is having all the knees and hips all go to one place. Is there other things that we could be doing?
Sure. We're not using web-based technology. Every other industry has. And I should be very careful here, because there are some parts of the country that are doing exactly this and have demonstrated that they can improve wait times and improve what's just generically referred to as access to care. So that wait times management software, that air traffic control is the way I like to think of it, software that manages all of the patients. Right now, in many parts of the country, you go and see your primary care physician, your GP, who then refers you by fax to an orthopedic surgeon, let's say, and you go see that surgeon and you agree to have surgery. And the whole process behind the scenes, not visible to you, the patient, is all paper-based currently in most of Canada. So that physician's office keeps paper charts and tries to keep track of their dozens or sometimes hundreds of patients on their wait list, and then must pick those patients and must schedule those patients at the hospital. And in the paper world, you can imagine trying to juggle that. It would be very difficult. So that's a piece that we're not doing very well everywhere in the country.
Okay. We're going to have to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the technology and the software.